Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Midterms 2014, a night of big wins for the GOP as Republicans pick up control of the Senate. Incumbent Senator Mitch McConnell, now Senate Majority Leader, declared victory early in the evening.
It's time to go in a new direction. It's time to turn this country around.
We are looking at all the results and the concerns of voters across this country, from the Senate and governor's races to the ballot questions. We are diving in this hour on Point, midterm elections. You can join us on air or online. What does this shift of power mean for the country for 2016? What happened in your part of the country? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thanks so much. Great to be here with some actual results.
Yes, exactly right. Also with us from Louisville, Kentucky is Molly Ball, national political correspondent for The Atlantic. Molly, you've been filing stories into the early morning hours. Great to have you as well.
Thanks. Hi, Jane. Hi, Karen.
And from Des Moines, Iowa, we're joined by Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University. Dennis, thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Hello, all.
So a commanding sweep, to say the least, for Republicans. Karen Tumulty, put these midterm wins into context for us starting out here.
Well, you're right. Basically, the Republicans, with very few exceptions, possibly being Governor Hickenlooper in Molly's home state of Colorado, won every single one that was expected to be close. And I think that that has a lot of implications. One, politically, it raises the question of, you know, as much as the Democrats have touted their high-tech turnout operations and their abilities to get to every voter, you know, whether, in fact, the Obama coalition shows up for anybody but Barack Obama. And I think for those of us in Washington, what it really suggests is, you know, there was the kind of boilerplate talk last night about getting things done. But I think it's pretty much of a formula for two more years of gridlock. And as of today, the table is being set for 2016.
Absolutely, which we will get to in this hour for sure. But Dennis Goldford, a lot of Republicans ran one-note campaigns, if you will, focused on Barack Obama. Was this an election of a simple referendum on an unpopular president?
I think it was. It's interesting that a lot of Republican leaders, from opinion leaders in the various opinion journals to even Sarah Palin, if she's a leader at least of a certain Tea Party-affiliated bloc of the Republican Party, have all said that this was a race that basically was an anti-Obama race. Basically, vote for me or vote for us because we're not Barack Obama and we're not happy with the world as it is today. The question will be indeed whether Republicans find a substantive agenda that they can pursue during the next 2 years and use as a place to run from in 2016.
Molly Ball, you're in Louisville, Kentucky, with the next Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell. Let's hear from him. Here he was last night speaking to supporters after his victory over challenger Alison Lundgren Grimes.
Whether you're a coal miner in eastern Kentucky who can't find work, or a mom in Paducah who doesn't understand why the government just took away her family's health insurance, I've heard your concerns. I've made them my own. You will be heard in Washington.
Molly Ball, Senator Mitch McConnell claimed victory last night only about 90 minutes after the polls closed. He's now the longest serving senator in Kentucky history and Senate Majority Leader.
Yes, and McConnell is such an interesting figure. He is not very well known or well understood because he seems to be sort of an inwardly directed person. He's more of a political tactician than he is a political performer. He's not particularly good at the sort of public parts of the job, the glad handing, the speech giving, but he is very good at the behind the scenes work, whether it's in the Senate or tactically in his political races. He feels that he doesn't get enough credit for this, but he has now run in 9 elections in Kentucky, a state that was pretty strongly Democrat at the time he started out. And he has won all of them. And he won last night by a much larger margin than most of the polls predicted. He won by more than 15 points against Alison Grimes, who really had the hopes of national Democrats riding on her shoulders, hoping to take out McConnell. One of the things I think is so interesting about McConnell is how diverse his enemies are, if you will, how sort of widely loathed he is. You know, liberals hate him because they see him as the man who single-handedly blocked the Obama agenda. But the people you might think would give him credit for that, the conservatives who want to see the Obama agenda blocked, they don't give him any credit for that. They feel he's been too conciliatory, too compromising. And so going to Karen's point, which I think is a good one, that's going to really put pressure on McConnell from both sides as he decides how to carry his majority forward. Is, you know, if he does try to work with the president, he's going to further infuriate those conservatives who have always suspected that he wasn't one of them. But on the other hand, there is a very large chorus of liberals and Democrats who are just waiting to vilify him for anything that he doesn't do to go along.
Well, let's dig into some of these races. Dennis Goldford, you're in Iowa, where Joni Ernst defeated Bruce Braley, a prominent Democratic congressman. She's going to become the first woman to represent the state of Iowa in the United States Senate.
This is the greatest nation in the history of mankind. And there is nothing we can't achieve. We are going to do this. But to get there, it starts with new leadership.
Yeah. Dennis Goldford, a lot of attention to this race. What do you make of it?
Well, Joni Ernst ran a campaign that was remarkably devoid of substance and detail, but very long on symbolism. From the time she won the nomination handily in a crowded Republican field in the June primary, she basically framed the race as one between a good, down-home country girl with Iowa values versus the evil big city slicker trial lawyer. And certainly the 38-second video we're all familiar with when Bruce Braley appeared to speak condescendingly of Senator Chuck Grassley, that played right into that narrative. But the Ernst campaign's media throughout the whole period, I'm talking about their own, not the outside ads, but her media campaign was absolutely artistic. And the Braley campaign was basically inept in responding to it and getting out a positive message of his own.
Democratic casualties stretched across the map from the conservative South to the more liberal Northeast. Karen Tumulty, what was the biggest surprise for you last night?
Hands down, it would have been the Maryland governor's race, where the Republican challenger, who I think just about no one was giving much of a chance even 3 or 4 days ago, upset his name is Larry Hogan, upset the Lieutenant Governor Anthony G. Brown, who really and truly not only appeared to have been coasting to a victory, but had, had basically had every single national Democrat of any kind of prominence into campaign for him.
Let's hear him, Republican businessman Larry Hogan. Here he is last night from his victory speech in the early hours of the morning in Annapolis, Maryland.
They said it couldn't be done here in Maryland. But together, we did it.
Indeed, a stunning upset in heavily Democratic Maryland. Molly Ball, did specific issues emerge in this campaign, immigration, foreign policy? Did specific issues help Republicans?
I think the climate helped Republicans. I think, as was said before, the issue in this race was really President Obama. And the president played into that when he said a few weeks ago that his policies were on the ballot. And I think we saw people react to that. But it was also very much about this sort of sense of fear and unease that a lot of people were feeling, the sense that, that America was sort of being battered by one crisis after another, and that the White House didn't seem to be in control, whether it was, scary things happening abroad, such as the Islamic State, whether it was the border crisis, whether it was Ebola, which, of course, hasn't had a very dramatic effect on us here in the United States, but which sort of sparked a panic that was difficult to tamp down. It was sort of, this is such a cliche, but it was sort of a perfect storm for Democrats in terms of all of the things, some self-inflicted, some not, that sort of seemed to all hit the White House right at the moment when they would most affect this sort of electorate that was already predisposed to be gloomy.
Mm. Dennis Goldfer, biggest surprise for you last night?
Well, I think it was how close the Virginia race was. People expected Mark Warner to have a relatively easy shot at that. And Ed Gillespie ran a very good campaign. I've not been able to see anything in the way of exit polls yet. My suspicion is that Warner just didn't get the margin in Northern Virginia that a Democrat needs in Virginia. But that's the one I guess has surprised me most. I wasn't really surprised that, say, Pat Roberts or Governor Brownback managed to hang on in Kansas, or certainly McConnell was not a surprise. I did think that Michelle Nunn might have made a little bit, at least from all the pre-election polls and such, might have had a little closer race against David Perdue. But, you know, when it comes down to it, when you combine Republican enthusiasm and intensity with Democratic discouragement and disengagement and disappointment, you get a recipe for Democratic catastrophe.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about yesterday's midterm elections, and you can join the conversation. Was this all about President Obama? About the economy? How do you see it? Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post is with us. Also from The Atlantic, Molly Ball. And Dennis Goldfer at Drake University in Iowa is here as well. Let's get a call in here. Paul is in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Paul. Welcome to On Point.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
The one blemish for the Republicans, at least on yesterday's victories, would be the loss of Scott Brown to Gene Shaheen in New Hampshire. But it seems like that's, for the Republican Party, is an important teachable moment going forward, at least for the 2016 presidential run. And that would be that moderates and rhinos like Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney need to stay home, stay away, and not sabotage Tea Party candidates like they've done in the past, because no matter right or wrong, a certain percentage of the GOP conservative base is going to stay home without a bona fide conservative candidate on Election Day. And that type of nominee will lose in the general election.
Mm. Paul, thank you very much. Let's hear from that race in New Hampshire. In a victory for Democrats, as Paul says, New Hampshire Senator Gene Shaheen defeated Republican Scott Brown to win a second term. Here is Gene Shaheen last night in Manchester, New Hampshire, saying she's committed to reaching across the aisle.
I promise you I will work with anyone in the Senate, Democrat, Republican, independent, to get things done to help New Hampshire's working families and our small businesses.
Karen Tumulty, the significance of that race in New Hampshire.
Well, that, too, was one of the few, I think, positive spots last night. Look, Scott Brown was basically trying to surf this environment. You know, he had just moved to the state. He had a big flub, in some of his it turned out not to be as big of a flub as it was initially portrayed in the media in sort of state geography in one of the late debates. But, you know, this is a situation where New Hampshire has had a long relationship with Gene Shaheen. She has been their governor. She has been their senator. And, you know, I think that in the end, people decided that however unhappy they were about Washington, that, you know, they were going to stick with her. But it was a lot closer than it would have been, I think, in just about any other environment.
Let's go to North Carolina, a big race there. Here is Republic Senate candidate Tom Tillis speaking to supporters in Charlotte, claiming victory over Democratic Senator Kay Hagan. He says that a Republican-controlled Senate will make changes in Washington.
We need to free the American people up to make America great again. We need to free the American people up to make it an economic superpower, a military superpower, and an energy superpower. These are the things that we're going to go to Washington and do.
And in her concession speech last night, Democrat Senator Kay Hagan thanked her supporters who stood with her.
You weren't just standing with me, though. You were standing with working families all across North Carolina. Those are the families that I have worked to represent my 6 years in the U.S. Senate. And those are the families that still need a voice.
The Senate race in North Carolina, Molly Ball, was the most expensive in Senate race in the country's history, more than $100 million, I believe. Tillis, his opponent had a slight lead in the polls coming up to Election Day, but Tillis won out.
And you saw that across the board. Republicans largely beat the polls. Most of their candidates won by bigger margins than the polls had predicted or came from behind in the polls to win. You know, I think the caller raises a really interesting point that, you know, we're likely to see a lot of recriminations on the Democratic side in the coming days, discussion of what went wrong with their tactics and with their message and that sort of thing. But the Republican civil war also is not dead. And a lot of these candidates who won are quite conservative, which does give ammunition to the conservative argument that this establishment Republican desire to have moderate candidates is misplaced. On the other hand, a lot of moderate Republicans did win, and someone like Charlie Baker, who is going to be the next governor of Massachusetts, or Bruce Rauner of Illinois, they didn't run as moderates. And even the sort of Tea Party tinged candidates in the Senate, people like Joni Ernst and Cory Gardner, they didn't run as Tea Party candidates. They ran to the middle. They ran as candidates who were speaking to swing voters about pocketbook issues and staying away from the sort of hot button polarizing topics and fringe rhetoric of some of the failed Republican nominees of years past. So I think that's going to be a real discussion to be had within the Republican Party going forward.
Let's hear from our voters and listeners now. Randy is in Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Randy. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. What I'm looking for is a little clarity and better understanding about this being a referendum on President Barack Obama, whereas the Republicans have their set of ideas why they don't like him. And it's primarily based on his agenda. But also the Democrats don't dislike Obama for the same reasons the Republicans do. The Democrats, it seems by and large, seem to be more disappointed that Obama hasn't been able to get through more of what his agenda is. All of this kind of clashing with the fact that the Republicans in Congress and the Senate have a lower favorable rating than the Democrats do, yet the Democrats lost big.
Randy, thank you. Let's see, Molly Ball, Karen, Dennis, were Democrats saddled with these dismal approval ratings in Congress as well as the president's board
members? I would add a third factor to Randy's point, which is that, and this is a story I wrote a few days ago, there was also the fact that a lot of these Democrats tried to distance themselves as much as they could from President Obama. For instance, Mark Udall in Colorado was saying, you know, I'm the last guy that the president wants to see coming up the White House lawn, when in fact their voting records were 96, 97, 98, 99% with the president. So there was a lot of frustration, I think, on the part of the president and his advisors that you know, it was going to be a fool's errand from the outset to try to pretend that there was any distance at all between these people and Obama. So they were frustrated that, you know, none of the candidates seemed to be going out and making a very forceful argument for what they have gotten done.
Molly Ball, how do you see it?
Well, I think that is going to be a big part of this debate that we hear. On the other hand, the candidates that Obama did campaign for in his own home state of Illinois, in Maryland, he went there. Those candidates lost, too, and he was being deployed only to very deep blue territory where he was perceived to be not as much of a drag. So, you know, there are not a lot of counter arguments for Democrats saying, oh, if only we'd run more strongly with the president or more strongly on the president's record, we might have won. I mean, this is the sort of wave that appears sort of indifferent to that kind of a message point, because Republicans were going to tie the Democrats to the president no matter what, whether or not they agreed with that or thought it was appropriate.
The mechanics of a midterm favor Republicans, though. Again, your average Republican voter is more likely to turn out for a midterm election than your average Democratic voter. In particular, three core constituencies for Democrats, young people, racial and ethnic minorities, and single women, tend simply not to show up as much in a midterm. 2008, of course, is an extraordinary year in terms of turnout. But if you use that as a baseline and look at 2010, the national Republican vote in 2010 dropped by 16 million, but the national Democratic vote in 2010 dropped by 30.5 million. Hmm. And hence you had the Tea Party enthusiasm. You have a lot a Republican House, a lot more Republican state legislatures and governors. I've not seen figures yet for the election that just occurred, but I would expect to see something similar. This is why the president was sent particularly to those areas to try to boost turnout among those core constituencies. But obviously it didn't work for Senator Udall in Colorado, where he really focused strongly on hot button issues to attract women like abortion and birth control.
Let me just hear from Mark Udall in Colorado. Republican Cory Gardner defeated him in the Senate race. This was another expensive race. This was nearly $70 million and a vital win for the GOP.
Tonight, we shook up the Senate. You shook up the Senate. Your message was heard from Nevada to Pennsylvania Avenue. As Republicans in Colorado, we've gotten used to the saying, wait until the next election. Well, I've got news for you. That next election, it finally happened.
Molly Ball, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say on Dennis's point about turnout, this is absolutely correct, of course, and you do hear a lot of Democrats pointing to it. But we talk about it in these sort of impersonal terms as if it were a fact of life like the weather. Well, why don't these people vote? They certainly could. Nothing's stopping them. It's not against the law. The fact is Democrats aren't giving them a reason to come out and vote. Democrats aren't giving them enough to go out and vote for in non-presidential years. They tried very hard to change that, mostly through, you know, turnout tactics and field organizing to try to change the composition of this electorate in this midterm, and it didn't work. So as Karen said earlier, you know, that poses big questions about what happens for Democrats when Obama is not on the ballot, even in presidential elections going forward.
Let's go to David in Richland Center, Wisconsin. Hi, David. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for what you do. I really appreciate your program and, of course, public radio. That's how I've been educated since I've been in Wisconsin, which has been 38 years. I'm feeling that I didn't get all that I wanted, but, you know, the people have voted. The Constitution does say for the people, by the people, and we heard the people. So I'm willing to go with that. And I really believe that there'll be cooperation. You know, Mr. Walker, I was undecided on the government race for right till the end. And even though Ms. Burke is brilliant and she'd make a good vice presidential candidate, no doubt about that, maybe you should pick her up. I don't know. But because we all know that's no secret that she's probably heading for the White House. But the bottom line is this. The working people have said, hey, you know, we need what we need, jobs. We want to get America back to where it was, where we can work, have a roof over our head, make a living, and be respected around the world. And everybody's blaming Obama, or everybody's at fault. I mean, he hasn't had a whole lot of cooperation. I haven't agreed with everything he's done, but he hasn't had any cooperation either. So we're all at fault. And I'm taking responsibility myself because I haven't done as much as I should have in the past, and I have been changing that lately.
Some blame to go around. David, thank you very much for your call. Let's hear from your state. Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin gave a victory speech last night. The governor drew a contrast between the way things are done in Wisconsin and in Washington.
Now that's a sea change, the difference between Washington and Wisconsin. You see, the folks in Washington like this top-down approach that's old and artificial and outdated that says the government knows best. We believe that you should build the economy from the ground up. That's new and fresh and organic, and that's what we're going to do.
Dennis Goldford, to David's point, our caller, you know, all these politicians say they want to be bipartisan. They want to get along until they get to Washington. I mean, do you see a different trail this time or just more polarized gridlock?
Well, I listened to Mitch McConnell this, the first thing in the morning say that he wanted to work together. And I thought a lot of Democrats will probably have a wry reaction to that because that, of course, is not what he said when President Obama was first elected. He wanted to make President Obama a one-term president. So they'll ask, where was that cooperation 6 years ago, more or less? But I think, again, the dynamics are such that what goes on in a given state or what goes on in a given district is not what goes on in the nation as a whole. So if you think of in 1998, the country as a whole was against impeaching President Clinton. But if you looked at the districts of the Republicans who controlled the House of Representatives, those voters would have thrown them out in an instant if they hadn't voted for impeachment. So the dynamic at a district or state level can be very different from what the overall national dynamic is.
Let's go to Roger in Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Roger. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. How are you? Well, I pretty much live in a hopeless state, unfortunately, for Democrats. But one of the things I question in Democratic strategy in all of the recent elections, they always do this. They play to the middle. Where is the Democratic version of the Tea Party that says, absolutely no torture? A living wage is a human right, and health care is a human right, and we're not going to compromise on these things. If we look at the success of the Tea Party, if we had a strong progressive base in the Democratic Party, I don't want Congress people that are bipartisan and are going to negotiate with these people. I want them to change America in a progressive way. Now, I went out and voted because their Supreme Court seats up at stake, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But a lot of the reasons that serious people that are on the progressive left will not gravitate to the Democrats anymore is their series of unrelenting compromises, like the promise that Guantanamo Bay would be closed that Obama gave us and did not do.
Got it, Roger. Thank you. What about this, Karen Tumulty? Roger says politicians playing to the middle. Where's the Democratic version of the Tea Party?
Well, I think that, first of all, that running to the left is probably not a smart strategy in some of the states that were on the ballot last night, Georgia being one of them, but also, Arkansas, Louisiana, North Carolina. But I think what he is likely to see is exactly much more of the kind of Democratic Party he'd like to see in the Senate, because a lot of the moderates have now been wiped out. And also, this Democratic caucus in the minority, it's always easier in the minority in the Senate to maintain unity. And, they are also not going to be in the mood to compromise on anything, because in 2016, the map is going to tilt very much in the Democrats' favor. The Republicans are going to be the ones defending a lot of seats, and in states that were won by Obama once or twice. And so these Democrats are not going to want to be doing anything that hands the Republicans any kind of achievements or that does anything to blur the distinctions between the two parties going into 2016.
And Molly Ball, Mitch McConnell, he's going to have his own fractious caucus to deal with, is he not?
He is. If you look at the incoming class of Republicans, a lot of them are quite conservative, and they come from conservative states, and they ran against Obama. So for them to suddenly go to Washington and be going along with things Obama wants to do may not sit well with those constituents and the promises that they made. And then, McConnell has a lot of moderates and deal makers and new senators from blue states in his caucus, but he also has people like Ted Cruz, who's been making noises a few days before the election about how this is proving that conservatives do need to run on a strong conservative platform and not go squishy. And then, of course, there's the House. Even if McConnell does get things through the Senate, the House, John Boehner's House majority got larger, which in some ways could give him more room to maneuver. He can lose more votes and still pass things. But on the other hand, the new members of the House are going to be quite conservative. They're going to add to that Tea Party caucus that's given Boehner so many fits. So that will be another stumbling block. And then I think, Karen raises a good point about Democrats' willingness to deal. They have to make a choice, too, as much as Republicans. Are they going to come to the table and possibly give their opponents a win?
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour about yesterday's midterm elections, and you can join the conversation. How do yesterday's election results set the stage for 2016? Any rising stars you saw emerge last night? My guests, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Molly Ball from The Atlantic, and Dennis Goldford of Drake University in Iowa. Let's go down to Florida. After winning a second term as Florida's governor last night, Republican Rick Scott called on supporters to, quote, forget about all the partisanship and move forward to improve the state.
Florida is on a mission. And that mission is to keep growing and to become the very best place in the world to get a job, to raise a family, and live the American dream.
Dennis Goldford, Republicans dominated gubernatorial races as well, picking up three new seats, including President Obama's home state of Illinois. What about the governor's races?
Well, you know, the governors actually have to deal with policy. They actually have to solve problems. They don't have the luxury, like senators quite often, of simply talking for a long time and campaigning symbolically. That's not to say senators don't have a particular agenda, but governors, again, have to get things done. And this works out very well for Republicans. We know that typically the best launching pad, at least in recent presidential cycles, to a presidential nomination is being a governor. Barack Obama was the first sitting senator to get a nomination since actually win the presidency since John Kennedy, if I remember correctly. So Republicans have done very well to capture these governorships. Additionally, to the extent that they will have anything to do over time with building their own organizations leading to the next redistricting after the 2020 census, this puts the Republicans in very good shape.
We talked about this election being a referendum on an unpopular president. When you parse out the gubernatorial races, does that theory still hold, Karen Tumulty?
Well, you know, gubernatorial races did have other factors, but I do think that all of these candidates benefited from the number of people who were showing up to express their anger, not only at President Obama, but at Washington. So, yes, I think that they definitely they played heavily in sort of who ended up showing up at the polls.
Derek is in San Carlos, Texas. Hi, Derek. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I've been through a number of elections, seen a lot of them, Republican landslides like this one, and what almost inevitably happens is that the major issues that were the talking points during the election never get addressed. I'm interested in knowing what your analysts will think actually might happen, other than perhaps some regulations being relaxed, maybe some additional tax cuts to support the financial backers of these Republican candidates. But will Obamacare be repealed?
Jane,
abortion be outlawed?
Derek, thank you. Karen Tumulty.
Yeah, I'd love to take this one because that is absolutely the subject of my story on the front page of the Washington Post this morning, where I say in the lead that there are two likely scenarios of what's likely to get done in Washington over the next couple of years, and that is not much and nothing at all. When you hear even, you know, Mitch McConnell, when he was asked, you know, what do you actually want to get? It was fairly, it was fairly modest stuff. You know, maybe we'll get to vote on the Keystone Pipeline. They're talking about potentially some trade legislation, potentially some, a few things on regulatory stuff. The House plans to immediately pass a lot of relatively narrow jobs bills that they've already passed that were languishing in the Senate. But nobody's talking about a grand bargain. Nobody anymore is talking about, I think, comprehensive immigration reform. It's going to be small ball for the next couple of years, and it's going to be difficult to even get that through.
We'll have
the
a
danger
link to,
for
yeah, Dennis, go ahead.
I was going to say the danger for Republicans, of course, is that especially if they want to engage in the sort of trench warfare against the Obama administration that Ted Cruz and allies talk about, whether it's trying again to repeal Obamacare or launch investigations and things like that, is it potentially sets them up for some Democratic candidate, whoever it might be in 2016, to run against, to use Harry Truman's old phrase, a do-nothing Congress. So again, with power comes accountability.
I was going to say, we'll link to Karen Tumulty's article in the Washington Post on our website, onpointradio.org. Molly Ball, voters decided ballot initiatives in 41 states, issues related to abortion, recreational marijuana, higher minimum wages. How did those important ballot initiatives shake out?
This is another thing that Democrats are pointing to as a bit of a silver lining, because these issues did go almost entirely to the leftward side of the spectrum. You had initiatives that would have sharply restricted abortion in Colorado and North Dakota being defeated. You had marijuana legalization initiatives mostly passing, although there was one in Florida, a medical marijuana initiative that got a majority of the vote but didn't get to the 60% threshold that it needed to pass, and minimum wage initiatives passing in, I believe, five states, many of them red states such as Arkansas. So Democrats are saying, well, what the heck, America? You voted for our issues but not for our candidates. Mm. And there is a little bit of a conundrum there. A lot of these Republican candidates as well ran on sort of a Democratic platform of talking about jobs and talking about better paying jobs for people with low incomes, talking about making contraception accessible in the case of Cory Gardner in Colorado, talking about renewable energy. So this is a sort of not very comforting moral victory for Democrats, but something that a lot of Democrats are pointing to say, well, at least people are with us on some of these issues. Mm.
Let's go to Brendan in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Brendan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to point out I'm an independent voter in New York with a conservative bent. I'm upset to hear Harry Reid make the comment today or last night that it's now time for the Republicans to cooperate, because Harry Reid was the same, along with President Obama, commenting that elections do have consequences. And the Democratic Party has spent the better part of the last 6 years sticking it to the Republicans and blocking any attempts for them to pass legislation in the Senate. I believe it is now time for the Republicans to turn the tables and make life very difficult for Harry Reid and the Democrats. And at the same time, I'd like to see them change the direction of the country from Washington and get us some things revised.
Brendan, thank you. I appreciate your thoughts. Let's get another thought from listener Mike in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Hi, Mike. Welcome.
Yes, hello. I was wondering, since the Republicans have the Senate and, of course, they've taken the House, does that mean that there's a better chance for a Republican president to be elected in 2016?
All right, Mike, you got right to it. Midterm elections always signal the unofficial start of the next presidential campaign. Karen Tumulty, start us out here. So much ground ahead, obviously, but in this moment, who do you see?
Well, I mean, we have to see who runs and who the Republicans put up. I actually think that what happened in the governor's races was very interesting. For instance, if Scott Walker had lost last night, you know, he would be essentially consigned to oblivion, I think, here. But this is a guy now who's won three elections in 4 years. And he because of his recall election. Mm-hmm. So I think he's a real contender now for some spot on the ticket. So, you know, until we see who the candidates are, I think we're just not going to know.
Molly Ball, what do you think?
Well, the political science on this, and Dennis probably has something to add here, is that it's very hard for any political party to win a third term, no matter what happens in the midterms. So having had a two-term Democratic president, that means that there are very few historical examples of that same party then going on to win the next election with a new candidate. George H.W. Bush obviously being a notable exception to that in 1988. And so I don't know how the midterm trend tends to affect that, whether there is any correlation between the size of the gains in the midterms or control of Congress by a certain party, and how that affects their chances to win the next election. But in hypothetical terms, you do hear a lot of Republicans talking about what we were talking about earlier in the show, saying we need to have a positive agenda. We need to show America we can govern. They elected us because we weren't the Democrats, but now we have to have something constructive to offer, something that says that we can do more than just say no to whatever Democrats put forward. So especially to the extent that there are members of the Republican senators who want to run for president, that is going to create an incentive for Republicans to do something other than simply send Obama things to veto and create more confrontation.
Mm. Dennis Goldford.
There's a generational shift that the Republicans have gone through and the Democrats have not gone through yet. If you look at the main potential candidates who are normally named on the Republican side of the aisle, you're talking about people who tend to be in their 40s and 50s. If you talk about the Democrats, if you talk about Hillary Clinton, of course, she, you know, some Democrats even wonder, do we want to go back to the 1990s, even though there's good support for her in the Democratic Party? But she would be, I believe, close to around 69 on Election Day, and Joe Biden would be already over 70. And Martin O'Malley has been poking around in Iowa, but with very little name recognition yet. And, of course, his own successor could not get elected in Maryland. But I remember at the steak fry honoring Senator Harkin in August, and or whenever it was, time flies in a hurry.
Yeah.
And the Clintons came out, and it was Hillary's first visit to Iowa since she lost in 2008. I talked to some people in the crowd, and I was talking to a mother and daughter in particular who were very firmly in favor of Hillary Clinton. But I said, if not Hillary, who? And they just sort of stopped short and said, you know, that's a really hard question.
Hmm.
So the Republicans have this generational shift, which gives them a fairly thick bench, if you will. The Democrats haven't had this shift, and they have a fairly thin bench at this point.
Very interesting. What about some of the newcomers in this midterm, some fresh faces, people like Republican Tom Cotton in Arkansas, Democrat Seth Moulton in Massachusetts, even Mia Love in Utah? Who looks really interesting or exciting to you after last night, Karen Dummelty?
Oh, goodness. There are just so many of them. And of course, we will all be getting to know them. I think Joni Ernst is going to be very interesting to watch in the Senate. And there are some races that I think completely escaped people's notice. You know, Texas elected its first African-American Republican congressman since Reconstruction. We have figures like Dave Brat, who came from nowhere, it seemed, to knock off Eric Cantor in a Republican primary. It's going to be a really interesting mix of characters, I think.
Molly Ball?
Yeah, and I would add to that there were a lot of Republicans who were not in contested races, so no one paid attention to them. But, of course, they get just as much of a vote. Ben Sasse in Nebraska is someone a lot of conservatives are quite high on. He has some establishment credentials, served in the Bush administration, went to Harvard, but also had the support of most of the Tea Party in his tough primary. People like James Lankford in Oklahoma, Shelley Moore Capito, the first woman Republican elected in West Virginia. So it's going to be taken as a whole, this class of incoming Republican senators who are creating the new majority, they're quite conservative. They may be the most conservative incoming class of Republicans ever, certainly in recent years. But at the same time, they've won these elections by having an ability to speak to the middle, not by running on sort of far-right ideas or Todd Akin-style rhetoric. So it's going to be very interesting and very much up in the air, I think, to see how they behave when they get to Washington.
Dennis Goldford, who caught your attention?
Well, I think the new women, Shelley Moore Capito, Joni Ernst, I think they add to the Republican caucus, of course, the conference in the Senate. It'll be interesting to see how those women's voices play out. We use the term women too broadly quite often because there's substantial differences among women. Bruce Braley barely beat Joni Ernst among women in Iowa, and normally a Democrat needs a big, big distinction, a big margin among women to overcome the gender gap in favor of Republicans among men. But Ernst obviously had substantial support among women. But I think there's a broader point here that was just raised and goes back to our first question about the question of the polarization. Political parties always have a problem between their purists and their pragmatists. You know, the pragmatists want to win elections. The purists say, no, there's this really hidden majority out there who believes firmly with us, we've got to activate them. So when Howard Dean in 2004 said, I represent the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, that was the view that there's this great liberal majority out there, and if the Democrats only nominate a candidate who's sufficiently liberal, they'll sweep to power. Well, what we've seen from the Republicans since 2008 is the reverse. There's a great conservative majority out there, and if you stop nominating squishy centrists and rhinos and moderates, they'll sweep to power and win the election and solve all of America's problems. I think to a great extent they all forget their James Madison, who argued there is no national and natural permanent majority. It's always a shifting coalition. The question will be how much these new folks, as you indicated, are willing to talk to the center.
Hmm. important midterm elections, Karen Tumulty, where do we go from here? What do you see moving forward?
Well, as I said, I'm, and again, from a lot of reporting, a lot of talking to people on both sides of the aisle, I don't get a sense that there is much likelihood of a lot of legislative action over the next couple of years. But let's face it, like I said, back to my original point, as of this morning, you know, the table is being set for 2016, which is both, you know, it keeps us going in the political reporting world. But I think most Americans get a little tired of this.
Karen Tumulty, Molly Ball, Dennis Goldford, thank you very much. A terrific conversation. We appreciate your time today, all of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great pleasure.
As you may have noticed, Tom Ashbrook has been taking some time off recently. He has been going through a difficult time. He has left this recorded message for you and for us. Tom, we want you to know we send our love and our thoughts are with you.
And now for all of our On Point listeners, who I very much think of as a kind of community, an important community to me, there's something personal I have to share. It's hard and it's as intimate as anything on earth. 42 years ago, I fell in love with a beautiful French-German immigrant girl named Danielle. We were 16. I was a farm boy from the little house on the prairie. She was everything I dreamed of. We've been lovers and partners ever since, lived all over the world, man and wife, three wonderful children, even a little grandbaby, a perfect love, really. And now, too early and to my dismay, my love is very, very ill. It's something she's managed gracefully for years, but it's just getting the better of her. I need to be with her. I'm going to have to take a little time away to do that and to face what comes with our family. It's one of life's tough passages, and I hope you'll keep me, us, in your thoughts while I'm away for a time to attend to love and family and then return. I thank everyone for your patience and your understanding. Some things we just have to take care of. I will, and I'll be back. So until next time, and it won't be long, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.